It is Monday, March 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, aid convoys reach Syria's eastern Ghouta region. Italy's populist parties lead in the election, but the future direction of the government remains to be determined. And the film The Shape of Water wins Best Picture at the Academy Awards. It's all ahead. United Nations and International Red Cross said Monday that convoys carrying humanitarian aid were able to enter Syria's besieged, rebel-held eastern Ghouta area. The ICRC Syria delegation said the 46-truck convoy carried food for 27,000 people, as well as medical supplies, while the UN's humanitarian office reported many life-saving health supplies were not allowed to be loaded. Meanwhile, Syrian President Bashar Assad said Sunday his regime's offensive against the eastern Ghouta region will continue in his ongoing effort to defeat what he calls terrorists. Mr. Assad, in remarks Sunday to journalists carried by state television, said, "We will continue to fight terrorism. We did not start in Ghouta. We started in Aleppo, in Homs, and Deir el-Zor." The Syrian leader insisted there was no contradiction between the daily humanitarian ceasefire and combat operations, allowing civilians to leave while hitting the terrorists. He said most people in Ghouta want a return to state control. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said government-allied forces have taken control of about one-fourth of the rebel enclave near Damascus, which has been under siege for 5 years. More than 650 people have died since the latest offensive began February 18th. The White House condemned the Russian and Iran-backed assault. In a statement Sunday, it said it has delayed implementation of the latest UN Security Council resolution that called for a 30-day ceasefire. It blamed Russia for ignoring its terms and killing innocent civilians, citing at least 20 daily bombing missions between February 24th and 28th. David Mack, a former ambassador and scholar at the Middle East Institute, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the Syrian leader's comments are vintage Assad, claiming he's fighting terrorists on behalf of all the Syrian people.
I've no doubt that there are some Syrian civilians who, out of sheer desperation and with the starvation tactics and so on, might prefer to make their peace with the Bashar al-Assad regime. But in fact, if they're doing it, that is under sheer duress. The evidence is that they are retreating farther east along with the various fighters, who include a substantial number of people that I think we would consider as terrorists, along with others who simply have been fighting for independence and to protect the civilians with whom they are related and neighbors and so on.
The United States made one of its strongest statements yet on Moscow's complicity in the civilian deaths in eastern Ghouta region. Russia has gone on to ignore a UN ceasefire and to kill innocent civilians under the false auspices of counterterrorism operations. Now, they've been tracking Russian warplanes, but they cannot prove those planes carried ordnance that dropped on eastern Ghouta.
Whether or not those planes were engaged along with the Syrian Air Force in dropping high explosive munitions and barrel bombs on the civilian population. The plain fact is that the Russians have not evidently exercised any serious degree of control over the Syrian regime and the Syrian military. They may even be operating with them, but even if they're not operating with them, I think that they are guilty of complicity because they obviously have the capability of cutting the Syrian Air Force off. It seems to me that if they may have started out with some kind of scheme for humanitarian relief corridors that was half serious, they have basically backed down from any serious humanitarian efforts in the face of the obstinacy of the Assad regime. It's quite clear that Bashar intends to subdue this area by a combination of attacks from the air and sending in armed groups that that may or may not include Syrian regular military, but would certainly include militias that are allied with him. And the Russians are simply not making an effort to restrain him.
David Mack of the Middle East Institute. He said the trajectory of the violence in eastern Ghouta appears to favor the Assad regime, but describes civilian acceptance of Assad regime rule in the short term extraordinarily unlikely. He said eastern Ghouta is an example of the failure of international diplomacy, especially the weakness of the U.S. to counter Syrian and Russian strategy. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. South Korea says North Korea's Kim Jong-un meets with South Korean officials. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and U.S. President Donald Trump will be meeting at the White House. Turkey arrests four people connected to a security threat at the U.S. Embassy. And President Trump would exempt Mexico and Canada from steel aluminum tariffs if a new NAFTA accord is reached. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
Scientists who studied a hot Jupiter-like exoplanet with NASA's Hubble and Spitzer Space Telescopes were able to detect signs of water in its atmosphere. And they didn't just find signs of some water, but a lot of water. Three times the amount of water on our solar system's own Jupiter. The exoplanet they studied is known as WASP-39b, located about 700 light-years from Earth. The detected atmospheric water of WASP-39b is said to be in vapor form. Although the exoplanet is now eight times closer to its host star than Mercury is to the Sun, the researchers say that because of the amount of water spotted, WASP-39b probably first developed far away from its star, where it was blasted by a great deal of icy material. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a senior Australian diplomat reveals strained relations with China. Italy will be thrown into weeks of backroom deal-making and behind-the-scenes horse trading as coalition negotiations drag on, prolonging political instability in one of Europe's biggest economies. I spoke with Jamie Detmer in Rome, who describes the results of the Italian parliamentary elections.
A muddle. The election was messy, marred by violence and marked by pretty vicious anti-migrant rhetoric, but also personal rhetoric against each other, you know, different parties, different leaders. And now it's a muddle. We have no outright winner. We have the right-wing alliance that Berlusconi, Silvio Berlusconi, the former prime minister, shaped, has the biggest bloc, but the biggest party is the Five Star Movement, the Maverick Anti-Establishment Party. Populists secured the biggest gains yesterday. The main left-wing party, which is the outgoing government, the Democratic Party, was hammered. And it's very unclear what kind of coalition can be created. The Lega, which is a group within Berlusconi's party, a populist far-right group that did very well yesterday as well, has ruled out any coalition with the Five Star Movement. The Five Star Movement is divided, with half of them saying they don't want to form a coalition with anyone else, and others saying they do. So the most likely scenario is lots of behind-the-scenes horse trading, lots of backroom deal-making, which will be nudged and overseen by Italy's president. And in the end, probably what we're going to see is a government of the president, which means that President Mattarelli will underpin an agreed program of government. and create an alliance really of odd bedfellows. So, I mean, the outcome is likely that all the carefree promises about tax cuts and benefit increases will go by the way, that we will have a gridlocked parliament, a gridlocked politics in Italy, whereby we won't get the overall populist promise delivered, which could either undermine the populist parties in the future or build up frustration that they feed up and they become even more powerful.
So there is a possibility, that the Prime Minister, Paolo Gentiloni, could remain in that post?
Yes, ironically, he could. If there's a government of the president underpinned by the president, he may well turn back to the former, the outgoing prime minister, to oversee this, because he's one of the few people who has got the diplomatic finesse, possibly be able to control such an unwieldy, odd coalition. And in fact, in the run-up to the election, many of Italy's elder statesmen were praising him, heaping praise on him, indicating that he might be the man who can stabilize Italy after the election. So in other words, Italians would have voted for change, there would have been a promised revolution, and they get more of the same as they had before the election.
Well, former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi is barred from taking office until 2019. Though, is there a possibility that next year he could return to government?
Well, one should never, I say, in Italian politics, say never. Yes, it is conceivable. It will be Byzantine and very complicated, but yes, it is conceivable. He's certainly going to be, along with his political partner Matteo Salvini and the head of the Five Star Movement, one of the key political ringmasters behind the scenes as we go forward. So this does represent a remarkable and an improbable political comeback by the old knight, as he's nicknamed, Silvio Berlusconi.
Jamie Detmer reporting from Rome. A high-ranking Australian diplomat has acknowledged Canberra's relationship with its largest trading partner, China, is enduring a period of complexity and difficulty. The candid comments from the head of the Australian Foreign Affairs Department came during a parliamentary hearing in Canberra. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Relations between Australia and China are rarely without problems or tensions. In recent months, Canberra introduced its biggest overhaul of intelligence laws in decades to try to combat foreign interference in domestic politics. While the Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull spoke of disturbing reports about Chinese influence in Australia, he has insisted the new measures were not aimed at one particular country. However, Beijing reacted with displeasure and said it had no intention of meddling in Australia's internal affairs. Those tensions still persist, according to Australia's most senior public servant. Frances Adamson, the head of Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, says the bilateral relationship is often fraught with turbulence.
Our relationship with China, there are, whichever government is in power in Australia, there are periods when the Chinese are not completely in agreement with everything that we might want to do in our national interests. It's important for us to assert that.
Another area of tension is the South China Sea. Australia has always advocated for freedom of navigation in international waters in the strategic waterway. But China claims sovereignty over most of the South China Sea, including a group of small islands, directly challenging the territorial claims of its neighbours, Malaysia, Vietnam, the Philippines and Taiwan. Australian Defence Minister Maurice Payne says Canberra will continue to assert its rights in the region.
Certainly in the last 12 to 18 months, 2 years really, we've made some quite significant increase in our activity in the region. And last year, the Australian Defence Force executed the largest joint task group that we have had in decades through the region.
Canberra must tread a delicate diplomatic line between China, its largest trading partner, a relationship that's underpinned recent Australian prosperity, and its long-standing military alliance with the United States that dates back to the early 1950s. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. The film The Shape of Water won the biggest prize at the Academy Awards Sunday night, taking the Oscar for Best Picture in a ceremony that honored a range of Hollywood movies. VOA's Los Angeles correspondent Mike O'Sullivan tells me about the Best Picture Oscar.
It was Guillermo del Toro, the Mexican director, who was named Best Director, and it was named Best Picture, and it won two other awards. So people say there are not often surprises at the Oscars, but it was kind of an open contest as to which film would win Best Picture and who would win Best Director. So that was not surprising, but it was not being predicted as a sure thing.
The Academy Awards took place amid this continuing concern about the Me Too movement and the Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein, the scandal around him. And Frances McDormand won for Best Actress. And she sort of reached out to people in the audience. She asked a number of women that were nominated to stand.
Well, this was the theme of the evening, and people were really waiting to see if anything very dramatic would happen. And it did when Frances McDormand walked up on stage, got her Oscar. She was obviously very excited. Then she put the Oscar down on the stage, and she asked all the women nominees in all categories, directors and screenwriters, and, you know, she went through a long list, and said, please stand up and join me. And they didn't join her on stage, but they stood up. And she said, basically, to everyone else, and these are the movers and shakers in the movie industry, she said, well, look at these women. She said, we all have stories to tell. We all have projects that need financing. And we want to meet with you, basically, and talk about this. And basically, our time has come. So, you know, that one of the movements was called Time's Up, and a lot of people were wearing those little pins that said Time's Up, and that was her message.
It moves it beyond just the Oscar ceremony itself.
It does, and this movement has so much momentum, not just the movement against sexual harassment. You know, people for years have joked about the casting couch, but it's a really kind of insidious thing when a young actress, and in some cases actors, but most often young actresses are being victimized by these older men who have this kind of power in Hollywood. And people have finally said enough is enough. We have to put an end to this.
But it's also, I think, an interest in getting women in addition to being on screen, but behind the screens as well, having more women producers and directors.
That's right. And this is the other side of it, is equality and inclusion. And there were three actresses up there who had all lodged complaints against Harvey Weinstein, along with scores of other women, but they're saying women represent such a small percentage of the directors and the writers and others who are making movies, who are getting the financing to get their stories on screen, that has to change as well. So it's a whole suite of demands, but the common theme is women's empowerment. The women have to be an integral part of this Hollywood system.
Well, in other categories, British actor Gary Oldman won Best Actor for his portrayal of the former Prime Minister Winston Churchill.
That's right, and it was an amazing transformation. The makeup and the hairstyling people for that film also won, because they were able to turn this guy, who's a very versatile actor, into a completely convincing Winston Churchill. It was like watching, clips from World War II newsreel. So that was such an impressive performance that a lot of people were expecting him to win, and he did.
And Allison Janney, who's been a well-known actress in Hollywood for years, she won for her performance as she played the mother of American figure skater Tonya Harding in the film I, Tonya.
That's right, and this was a woman, according to Tonya Harding, who was controlling and very difficult, and she just managed to capture this. But a woman who was also largely responsible for this figure skater, Tonya Harding, for pushing her so that she achieved what she did. And of course, people remember that name because she kind of kneecapped another skater, Nancy Kerrigan. So it was a big scandal at the time, and people wondered what was going on. But this was, apparently the story behind that news story, and she really captured the character of the mother.
And I believe Jordan Peele won for Best Original Screenplay. He won for his film Get Out. I believe he is the first African-American to win that award?
Yes, apparently no African-Americans have won the screenwriting award. This is for an original screenplay. But this relates back to the theme of inclusion, because a couple of years ago we had the Oscars So White movement on Twitter when there just weren't any black nominees in any of the major categories. So it's not just women, it's people of color and people who have just been outside the power structure of Hollywood, who are demanding, and are finally becoming included in these major areas like direction and screenwriting and the others as filmmakers.
That's VOA's Los Angeles correspondent, Mike O'Sullivan. That is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is increasingly clear that no geographical area is more important to the future of the United States than the Asia-Pacific. It is home to one-third of the world's population, produces one-third of global GDP, and boasts some of the largest and most dynamic economies in the world, said Acting Assistant Secretary for East Asian and Pacific Affairs Susan Thornton in recent testimony before the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. But there are very real security and economic challenges in the Asia-Pacific region, including the menacing threat of North Korea, the rise of an authoritarian China, and the spread of terrorism and extremism. The threat from North Korea continues to increase. Tensions and extremism are on the rise, she said. Backsliding on democracy, governance, and corruption and human rights is also undermining prospects for stability and growth in some countries. These problems will not be resolved without strong, determined leadership, and the administration of President Donald Trump is determined and up to the task. In response to Kim Jong-un's attempts to develop North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile capabilities, the United States initiated a maximum pressure campaign of strong diplomatic actions and economic sanctions against North Korea. Many of our allies around the globe have followed suit, restricting or ending North Korean diplomatic activities, severing all trade ties, and imposing or tightening economic sanctions on North Korea. We have also made clear to China our desire for a productive relationship, and that we must work to manage and resolve differences. But we will not tolerate any attempts to displace the United States in Asia, or to coerce or bully countries in the region. Finally, we continue our work with APEC to promote high standards and fair trade, and to support ASEAN-centered regional architecture. The administration under President Trump's leadership is working to expand and deepen partnerships throughout the region via our Indo-Pacific strategy to ensure that countries have support to make their own decisions and don't feel pressured to take on obligations that undermine good governance or long-term growth, said Acting Assistant Secretary Thornton. The United States is a Pacific power and will remain committed to this region's success.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.